Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
Welcome to Warden's Watch Wild, where we talk to wildlife professionals. Brought to you by the Village Gun Store, Whitefield, New Hampshire. I'm your host, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch Wild. In this episode of Warden's Watch Wild, we have biologist Alex A. Sarin. Did I say that right, Alex A.? I always mess up names. I'm bad. Sarin.
Pretty close. It's Saran, like Saran wrap.
Like Saran wrap? That doesn't sound Norwegian, really, though.
No. Oh. It's actually Swedish.
Swedish, okay. See, no wonder it doesn't sound Norwegian. So. and Alex A. and I met when he was doing, was it your PhD work, Alex, that we met on, or was it your master's? It was your PhD work?
It was the start of my master's, yeah.
The start of your master's.
We've actually known each other for close to a decade now.
And Alex A. Worked on some snowshoe hare and climate change and indicating species of what was going on climate change above 2,500 feet. Am I correct, Alex, with that? Those higher elevations, I should say.
Yeah, you're hitting on a lot of it. Yeah, so we did have a lot of focus on high elevation populations in the eastern United States or eastern North America. Not a lot of research has been done on high elevation snowshoe hare populations or even high elevation carnivore populations as well. It's mostly hasn't been done because it's just hard to get into those areas. You got to hike into those areas, and it's much easier to do research in the lowland areas where you can drive to places. So
No doubt. I certainly understand that after hiking some of those areas with you and sending my son on the treks with you to check your trap line and stuff.
That's so, right.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. He got a kick out of that. So, but I kind of want to focus on the snowshoe hare and their life cycle, their importance, and that's what I want to highlight this Warden's Watch Wild about is the snowshoe hare, your experience with them, their importance, population increase and decrease, and you know how important they are to us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, snowshoe hares they're often called the candy of the woods, at least for the carnivores that are out there. They are really important species for carnivore populations, for keeping them on the landscape. And when their populations kind of decline, carnivore populations can decline as well. They're really inextricably linked to the Canada lynx. That's one of the most important prey species for the Canada lynx is the snowshoe hare. And their researchers have studied lynx and snowshoe hare population cycles for the past 100 years. And a lot of the data that came from that was from fur bear trapping in Canada and being able to identify these cycles. And so, yeah, for the snowshoe hares, they also influence forest growth as well. Forests are cut. They really like more early, younger forests, early successional younger forests. And so they require these areas with real thick cover from protection from predators, but also to kind of stay warm during the wintertime. And also it provides food in a lot of those areas where you have a lot of that young growth coming up And so they can be eating the twigs and the buds from a lot of the trees that are emerging in the shrubs. And so they get a lot of food from it. And so in from eating it, just like moose, you know, then when they're eating these young trees, it also influences how forests regrow. Moose have more of an impact than snowshoe hare, but snowshoe hares can definitely have an impact on them. And so they're, as the name, you know, most folks would know, as the name implies, it's a snowshoe hare. And so they're really adapted for snow, for deep snow areas. They change their coat color seasonally. So, well, most do. New research has shown some of these more southern populations have either introgressed, means they've interbred with some jackrabbits in the Northwest. They stay brown all year round. Or in the Northeast, there's some populations in Pennsylvania that remain brown all year round as well. And there's no introgression going on there, and maybe just some sort of a mutation or adaptation to the local environments that have become more snowless over the past 100 years. But yeah, that change in coat color from brown during the summer to white during the wintertime really helps them kind of stay camouflaged and blend in with the environments. And it's one of those life history strategies that allows them to survive. Then they have these really light bone density and really large feet that allows them to stay on top of the snow in really deep snow environments. But those are really kind of key kind of like traits that they have that allow them to live in really deep snow areas. So the work that we've done over the past 10 years, including most of the work that was originally done out west, really shows that these, especially shorter winters and longer falls when there's fewer days of snow on the ground, snowshoe hares, they change their coat color, but if there's no snow on the ground and they're white, they really stick out like a sore thumb, and they're more susceptible to become predated upon by carnivores or predators such like avian predators like hawks and owls and stuff like that.
And people too.
And people, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
I know some of the hunters kind of like to go stalking at that point, seeing those hares stick out really good.
I almost feel like I don't want to hunt during that time of the year because it's kind of unfair, isn't it? It is, exactly. Yeah. There was one December I just didn't really hunt because I was like, this is too easy.
Yeah. No, not fair when you can see them standing out like that. And they have a tendency not to think that you can see them because one of their other defenses is not to move until it's too late, I guess you could say. But, you know, even as they get closer, if they don't think they're being seen, I mean, I've got within 3 feet of them and they still won't move, thinking they're invisible. And that's also something that's built into them as well, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. So you have an individual variation where, you know, fair amount of individuals will freeze and they won't move, but then you have some that will move earlier. And that would happen when we were doing our walk-ins because we would, you know, during our 5-year study with snowshoe hares, we radio collared hares in the Nulhegan Basin in northeastern Vermont and in the White Mountain National Forest up at high elevations. And there were certain animals either when you trap or that when you'd radio collar and then you'd go find them again to be able to figure out if they were alive or figure out what habitats they were using. Some would stay, hold tight, exactly like you described, but some would flee much earlier than that. And that individual variation among populations is really important. Sometimes it's important to flee, and sometimes it's important to stay right there. And so that individual kind of variation is important for population persistence. Certain traits will benefit a population where other types of traits won't. But it's important to have the variation of those traits within a population to kind of allow for survival in different conditions where certain traits will be more beneficial under certain conditions. So yeah, it was really neat to see that. So exactly what you were describing, you'd have that some would stay, but then some would leave very early and consistently leave early, you know?
Yeah. So, and that makes total sense for survival of the population that some would hold when it's time to hold. And maybe they're totally camouflaged when other ones with a flea would be seen and vice versa. Yeah. When there's no cover, no snow, it's probably a good idea to run early than hold tight. So that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Any other interesting facts you learned about snowshoe hares, like how far they ranged when you were collaring them? Because I'm kind of curious.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of the, you know, work that we're, you know, working on publishing right now, some of the really interesting things was just to see these differences between these population level differences between like the White Mountain National Forest and the high elevation populations, and then these lower ones. So a lot of these Lower elevation populations were in areas which had been harvested extensively during the spruce budworm epidemic or outbreak during the 1970s and 1980s. And as a result of that, there was all this salvage logging, and, you know, which is pretty common and was pretty common in northern New Hampshire and throughout most of northern New England. And as a result of it, that all of these forests that were harvested, and 15 to 30 years after the harvest, which is optimal, like habitat, snowshoe hare habitat, you had tons and tons of snowshoe hare habitat, real dense spruce fir thickets. And that resulted in high populations of snowshoe hare, which is why lynx were able to lynx populations are at probably the highest they've ever been in the northeastern United States because of all the harvests that happened in the 70s and 80s. And as a result of that, you think, oh, this is great. High abundance populations. Well, it is. I mean, there's a lot of snowshoe hares out there, and you were able to have these endangered carnivore reestablish some of these areas. But what that means is that you're attracting a lot of predators, right? So you have high density, have a lot of predators. And so we would measure that with our study, that comparative study. And then those high elevation populations in the White Mountain National Forest, they haven't been harvested since 1900s. There were fires and there were some harvests, the last ones that occurred during the 1900s. And a lot of those areas have never been harvested before in the White Mountain National Forest. They're just too steep. So you have these forests that are anywhere from 100 to 300, 400 years old. And so it's very, very similar to what the forests were like maybe pre-Columbian times, where you just have these older forests, and the most dominant like disturbance regime in these areas is blowdown, right? You just get these blowdowns, and maybe every once in a while you get a hurricane that comes through, but you get a lot of ice damage, and then you have trees topple over. But what ends up happening is that you have little areas where you have this regrowth. It's enough to support snowshoe hare, but it's not enough to create these super high density populations. And so what ended up happening was we captured fewer hares in the White Mountain National Forest up in these older growth forests, but they'd still be there. And we would capture, a lot less. And the densities were significantly lower in the White Mountains compared to the low elevation harvested, timber harvested areas. But there was a trade-off, right? Because these high density snowshoe hare populations would attract all these predators. And so survival was significantly lower in these areas where there was a lot more snowshoe hares around. And also parasitism, they are susceptible, doesn't kill them, but they get rabbit ticks. And all of the hares we captured in the high density population at low elevation had, every single one of them had rabbit ticks when we captured them all over on their ears during the summertime. Mm-hmm. They don't have them during the winter. But all of the hares at high elevation, none of them had rabbit ticks on them at all. Only one. During the 2 years we trapped, had one rabbit tick on it, and it was the lowest elevation one. And they had much higher survival. So there was that trade-off. You could either live in an area that had great resources, you had tons of food, but that means there's going to be more of you. And that means there's going to be more likelihood that you're going to encounter ticks that are going to be on you. And also you're going to have a higher likelihood of being killed by a predator compared to this high elevation population that's not a lot of habitat, but not a lot of snowshoe hares, but those hares that are living there have this advantage where they have much higher survival and they don't have to deal with any ticks. So it was really kind of interesting to see those differences. And their home ranges, this gets back to what you were saying before, their home ranges were huge up at high elevation, because remember I was saying before that you'd have those blowdown and you have these little patches of what we call rabitat. Little patches regenerating.
Rabitat, I love it.
Yeah, so you'd have little patches, but they were few and far between. So they'd have to travel to these patches. And as a result of that, they had some of the largest home ranges documented in Eastern North America. And so that was pretty exciting to see those differences between them. Whereas the ones at lower elevation were kind of your typical average home range in a high density population, which was anywhere from like 4 to 8 hectares, or maybe 2 to 4 hectares, which was in acreage terms, maybe is what, 10 acres. And there was a lot of overlapping of home ranges as well. There were a lot of snowshoe hares in one area. They were kind of stacked on each other. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was, I think, probably the most exciting, findings that we had from the work that we were doing.
Huh. Very interesting.
So
see, people that ever knew that rabbits could be so interesting.
Yes. Oh, before it, I was always kind of interested in them, and I would hunt them, and it was enjoyed being out there and watching them and eating them. And it's kind of funny now, ever since that I've done this project and I've captured them and radio collared and actually had some experiences working with them, I am less interested in hunting them because I feel like they're not my pets, but you know, you just develop this connection with them. And so I still go out snowshoe hare hunting and really enjoy it, but it's definitely, I don't do it as much as I used to.
Right. So. Yeah, you've learned to appreciate what they do and how they live. And
yeah, yeah, exactly.
You formed a connection, Alex, to the,
I know.
The snowshoe hare.
I ruined it.
That's excellent. Well, thank you very much for, that's the nice thing about this Warden's Watch Wild. I learned things on it as well. Everybody always thinks game wardens know everything, and I can always learn too. And especially from people like you, I just always enjoyed our talks, and I've always been enlightened by all my biologist friends. So I'm really happy that we can bring this forward and teach everybody else about life cycle of snowshoe hare and the differences and, you know, the research that you've done and what you've learned, because that's pretty new and cutting stuff. The largest documented ranges in the Northeast, that's substantial.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Wayne, and I always enjoy chatting with you about this stuff as well. I feel like I learn a lot more, and yeah, it's always fun. I appreciate your questions.
Great.
Always get me thinking.
Well, thank you, Alex. Welcome to Warden's Watch Wild, where we talk to wildlife professionals. Brought to you by the Village Gun Store, Whitefield, New Hampshire. I'm your host, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch Wild.